To tell you a little bit about ongoing work on ways to test gravity on cosmological scales. Is this working? Yeah, I turn it on.
Yeah, no, it's fine.
Okay. Okay, good. As we all know, it's a very exciting time for modern cosmology. We have an impressive array of ongoing and upcoming surveys, which are going to, through imaging and spectroscopic techniques, are going to map and reconstruct the expansion rate, the growth rate, and lensing effect over a wide range of redshift, which corresponds to a huge portion of the life of the universe. So we are receiving and will receive over the next years high precision cosmological data. And there's great excitement about that, but there's also awareness that we face major challenges in cosmology. We still cannot really make much sense from the theoretical point of view of what is making up 95% of the current energy budget of the universe. 70% of that is, roughly 70% of that is in what we refer to as dark energy, and is what accounts for the source of cosmic acceleration. And the other 27% is what is responsible for the structure that we observe around us and we refer to as dark matter. We still need compelling theoretical models for both of these entities, and in this talk I will focus mainly on the challenges associated with trying to explain what is sourcing cosmic acceleration, so if you want, with dark energy. While we have compelling observational evidence to the point that a Nobel Prize was given for the discovery of the accelerated expansion of the universe, we still lack a compelling theoretical model for that. It could simply be a cosmological constant sourcing it, or it could be some modifications of the laws of gravity on the large scales in order to achieve self-accelerated solution, or some dark component, the dark energy, which is smoothly distributed as sources the acceleration at late times. And we have been thinking about that quite a lot, perhaps too much, to the point that now we are faced with a jungle of models, not really a compelling one, but many of them. And it is kind of cumbersome if you start looking at this map of models, whether you like to go the way of modifying gravity, whether you like to go with the cosmological constant or introducing some dynamical dark energy field and branching out in several directions. Many proposals have been put forward, but we still lack strong arguments in favor of one of these models. So the idea behind cosmological test of gravity is let us keep an open mind. And of course, we want, first of all, to test for the consistency of the data with the cosmological standard scenario, lambda CDM. But we want also to explore the parameter space allowed to alternative models in order to make sure that we do not miss out on the potential of data and possibilities of observing and testing something that goes beyond lambda CDM. So what are the players in this game? What are the functions of interest with which we want to perform this test? So from the magic point of view, I will focus mainly on linear scalar perturbations around an expanding FRW universe, flat universe. So functions of interest are the scale factor, which describes basically how the universe is expanding at the background level. And the other two functions of interest, since we are focusing on the on scalar perturbations, are two metric potentials, function of time and scale. And the one entering the 0-0 component of the metric is what is responsible, is what we can, basically what drives and governs the dynamics of non-relativistic probes, such as the growth of structure and peculiar velocities. The combination, the sum of these two potentials, is what is governing the relativistic dynamics. So we can have a handle on it by looking at effects such as weak lensing and the integrated Sachsov effect on the cosmic microwave background. Along with metric, we have matter components. So the players are photons, baryons, neutrinos, dark matter, which for this talk will be just, I will just be assuming cold dark matter, and possibly dark energy or modifications of gravity. So the idea is to test the theory which is governing the interaction and evolution of all these quantities. And the equations that we have available are Einstein equations, which are basically telling you how the metric quantities are related to the matter ones. And one of the approaches to cosmic acceleration is to modify these equations. And then we have the Boltzmann equations, describing how all these matter components evolve. As I was saying, I will focus on, as I said already, scalar perturbation, but I will focus on the linear regime. So on all those scales and redshift, where the evolution, I can safely treat linearly the evolution and growth of these perturbations. So the main question is, okay, we have these functions of interest, all these matter and metric fields. How are we going to test and learn something about the theory governing the relation between these quantities? So mainly it is, what are the features we want to look out for in the large-scale structure that can help us test the underlying theory? So let me summarize with one slide what we typically think of as the standard cosmological model when dealing with large-scale structure, linear scalar perturbations. So lambda CDM is based on GR, so the Einstein equations are that simple, and the most important quantity at late times is cold dark matter, which is clustering, and it doesn't carry any anisotropic stress, and it has negligible pressure. So it's a matter component characterized mainly by the perturbation in the energy density. And since the expansion is driven by the cosmological constant, the equation of state is equal to minus one. And if you go through the exercise of looking at the equations, linear equations for the perturbations, you will learn that since anisotropic stresses are negligible at late times, the two metric potentials are the same. And there is a very simple relation in Fourier space between the density contrast of matter, which is related to this quantity here, and this metric potential, the so-called Poisson equation. Very simple algebraic relation, valid on all linear scales. So if you want to summarize what we know about lambda CDM and what is important from the point of view of growth of structure, it is that given that phi and psi are the same quantity, relativistic and non-relativistic probes respond to the same metric potential. Through this equation, the Poisson equation, we see that the growth of structure is scale independent or linear scales. And there is a consistency relation between the growth rate of structure and expansion history. Going through the same exercise for different models of modified gravity or dark energy, we have learned that typically the dynamics is much richer. Even if this model have enough freedom to accommodate an expansion history which can be identical to the standard one in lambda CDM, still the growth pattern for perturbations can be quite different. And one of the first signatures that we have learned about is that typically the growth of structure becomes scale dependent, and the two metric potentials are not anymore the same. So it has become clear that it is very important in order to tackle dark energy and what is sourcing cosmic acceleration to combine probes of the expansion history with probes of the growth of structure and lensing. So if you want, in a line, we can say that typically modified theories of gravity or dark energy models that go beyond the vanilla quintessence one are characterized by an expansion history which can be very close, so identical to lambda CDM, but differences at the level of dynamics of perturbations. So in other words, relativistic and non-relativistic probes do not respond to the same metric potential. The growth of structure is now scale dependent, and there is the consistency between expansion rate and growth of structure is broken. So, the idea is, to try to use all this in order to make the most of the data that will be delivered to us from cosmological surveys in order to learn something about the underlying theory. How can we do that? So the idea is to go through an intermediate step, that is that of introducing parameterized frameworks in order to maximize what we can extract from data about the dynamic and learn about relation between all the different quantities at play, and then later eventually map what we have learned into specific theory. So what do we mean about parameterized when we say parameterized frameworks, and what can you parameterize? There are a few options that you have, and I will focus on two on which I work, which is you can think of parameterizing the solutions of the equations of motion, and I will describe what that means. And that is done typically in terms of two functions of time and scale. Or you can think of working at a higher level and parameterize the action, describing linear scalar perturbation. And that is done through a very recent approach, that is the effective field theory of dark energy. I will describe both. And for both of these approaches, I will also discuss the numerical implementation into the software that allows us to get predictions to compare with observables. If you want, the first approach is more phenomenological in nature. There's, you really lose a lot of contact with the theory, but you maximize what you can extract from data and store into these two functions. This one is an attempt instead of staying closer to theory. So let me start first with this mu and gamma and this corresponding software, which is so-called MG-CAMP, modified growth CAMP, where CAMP is the popular Einstein-Boltzmann solver. So how are these functions introduced? We want to basically parameterize deviations from the standard cosmological scenario in the behavior of linear scalar perturbations. So the idea is to do not touch anything in the energy matter sector. So leave the energy momentum equations the same one. Here I'm writing those for cold dark matter, but modify the Einstein equations. But in a very simple way, saying simply that I've learned that when you modify the theory or when you have a non-trivial dark energy field at play, typically the relation between the two potentials is changed, and the Poisson equation is also modified. It can be, of course, since you have extra degrees of freedom, generally the equations will be higher order. I do not really worry too much about those details. I just put everything into saying that the relation between density contrast and the Newtonian potential will be modified and the function of time and scale, and similarly the relation between the two metric potentials. These functions are built in such a way that they are constant and equal to one in the standard cosmological scenario. Deviations of this function from one would be in principle a hint of deviations from lambda CDM. And the fact is, you can see that you are losing touch with details of the theory, but you really have something in which it is very simple to store all the information that you can gather from data. And later on, you can project it into a theory. So we have implemented this approach into CAMB. CAMB is the Einstein-Boltzmann solver. So it's this software that takes all the Einstein and Boltzmann equation describing the evolution of the perturbations and give you as an output what you want to compare with data. So the spectra, for instance, for the cosmic microwave background, matter spectrum, the behavior of weak lensing, and so on. So we have modified that code introducing this parameterized framework, and basically you can run this software in order to extract predictions for your observable for many different choices of the functions mu and gamma.
These are the constraint equations that are being modified. The evolution equation is something also expected to be modified?
Yeah, you basically work out from this what happens at the level of the equations that we evolve in CAMB. Friedman equation, no, it's not modified. The
so
background Friedman equation.
The CDM,
typically, yeah. That's one of the limits of the of the model. So there's a lot of work that you need to do in order to project that into changes that happen at the level of the equations in synchronous gauge that are evolved in CAMB.
So this code is saying that there's no modification to the evolution.
But that's not, you're talking about tensor modes there, or?
No, even the scalar modes, but the equations that would have time derivatives in them.
There will be modifications to the equations. Yeah, you can work this out and map them into, and there will be a modifications in the evolution in the equations that are evolving CAMB. Yeah, it will involve also derivatives of this function mu and gamma.
There would be new functions that I could expect to have.
No, you do evolve the same set of equations, but they are modified. Yeah, so this mu and gamma are kind of the time dependence, I mean, the time and scale dependence of this mu and gamma are kind of eating what would be your extra degree of freedom. Yeah.
So I guess the assumption you're not violating the equivalence principle, right? So the fluid equations, the continuity, and Euler equations don't change.
So you don't touch the Boltzmann
right.
sector of the
code. All you need is this.
Yeah.
And I guess also that you have only one scalar degree of freedom. So the equation, whatever dynamical equation it would have, would be implied by, you know, conservation of the mu nu, which is assumed in the initial equation. So you don't really need it to involve consistently the data.
But that doesn't give you any constraint on mu and gamma. Yeah.
From Planck 2015, we know that the angular power spectrum, for example, acoustical power spectrum, is fitted to 1%. And the omega B, omega contact matter, or whatever, omega lambda, is known to 4 or 5 figures. So surely this must place a serious constraint.
I will show you actually constraint. They have also, in the Planck 2015, they have also tried to explore constraints on mu and gamma indeed. So I will show you a little bit on that. It has, yeah, but there's still a little bit of room. it places constraint. There's also the Lensing now effect on the CMB, which is measured well and places some interesting constraints. But I will show you that it's not that stringent as you might expect what they can currently say on mu and gamma. Yeah. Also because typically, as she was saying, you start in this approach, you have a lambda CDM background. So what are the choices that you can do for this mu and gamma? Because if you want to face data, you have to be more specific, right? You cannot just tell somebody, okay, give me constraints on mu and gamma as a function of time and scale. So different things have been tried. One first attempt is to forget about scale dependence of these functions and focus only on their time dependence. So different collaborations, for instance, the CFHT Lens, has tried to explore constraint on this function mu and gamma by assuming they're just time dependent and their evolution is tied with the background evolution of the dark component. Or analogous choices have been done with a transition from a standard GR scenario to a modified one. Of course, you are kind of making choices, so you are going back to some sort of model, to some extent, to a model dependence. If you want to try to keep scale dependence into the game, it is a bit hard. You can make progress if you restrict to the so-called quasi-static regime, which is when you can neglect time dependencies of the functions with respect to the special gradients. Indeed, in that case, for a broad class of models, scalar tensor models in particular, you can write down forms of mu and gamma in this as a ratio of polynomials, even in second order in K. All you are saying when you make that choice is that you have an extra scalar degree of freedom with a coupling to matter and with some mass, so some length scale characterizing its range of the fit force that it mediates. This turns out to be a fairly good approximation for the F of R theories, for what happens in F of R theories. So it has been widely used to put constraints on F of R. So you might have seen many papers setting constraint on this B0, which is just a boundary condition defining F of R models that reproduce lambda CDM expansion history. And so far it has been done just by using this form for mu and an equivalent one for gamma. You might be unhappy about making such specific choices because you're kind of falling back into model dependence, which is what we try to avoid at the beginning in setting up all this framework. So an alternative way to avoid doing that is to employ principal component analysis techniques. So really treat this function mu and gamma as completely unknown and create a grid in the space of time and scale of interest and bin those functions into this grid and treat the value of this function on each of the bins as one of your parameters. It's a great forecasting tool. It allows you to explore the potential of surveys to constrain this function. How you can learn, I won't enter into the details, it's cumbersome, but things that you can learn and that we have learned going through the exercise of doing principal component analysis for mu and similarly gamma as function of time and scale, is learning where in scale and redshift the survey will be most sensitive to features in this function, how many degrees of freedom they will be able to constrain, and depending on how narrow these transitions are, what is to what extent the surveys will be able to constrain features in this function. So it is a great forecasting tool, and you basically are able to also learn about what are referred to as the sweet spots for a given survey, regions in time and scale where that survey will be really great at constraining potential deviations from lambda CDM. But back to specific choices and to Planck. So Planck recently released data and results in March 2015, and they had a paper focus, for the first time, they had a paper focus on constraints on dark energy modified gravity. And they showed constraints on function mu and gamma by making different choices for the time dependence. So first, initially they neglected scale dependence in this function, and they look at constraints on mu and similarly gamma by assuming, similarly to CFHT lens, a dependence of mu related to the background evolution of the dark component or a sort of Taylor expansion analogous to the CPL expansion for the equation of state. They have marginalized, for instance, on with this function one and look just at constraint, show us constraint on the two-day value of this function mu and gamma. And this is showing, going from black to red, is showing what are the constraints, joint marginalized constraint that you can get if you consider only Planck. Planck with some background data, baryon supernovae and Hubble, and then adding external data that have something to say about growth of structures. So weak lensing data from CFHT lens and redshift space distortion data. And you see that lambda CDM would lie here at the intersection of these two dashed lines because mu and gamma are equal to one, constant and equal to one. They seem to find in both cases some hints of deviation from lambda CDM, which is which becomes stronger and get almost to 3 sigma when you get into the game redshift space distortion data and weak lensing. It is really just a tension between, picking up tension between the data sets. And basically, the tension that was already known between the sigma 8 as extracted from weak lensing data and the one as extracted from cosmic microwave background.
So gamma of not being one, isn't that anisotropic stress? Is that right?
Yeah, okay. Yes. So I'm not sure, yeah. And this is rescaling basically the Newton constant in the Poisson equation. So going to mu minus one smaller than zero, it means that you are preferring a theory that gives less clustering. Which is just trying to.
Still within one sigma of zero, but then gamma minus one.
Gamma is driving, yeah. But yeah. And So you can, they also look at a different combination, which is an alternative function, combining mu instead of with gamma with sigma, which is this, what is relating basically the lensing potential with density contrast. And of course, the constraints and conclusion that you draw are model dependent and also depend on the functions that you consider.
So the anisotropic stress parameter, that could be non-zero if you just had a standard, a quintessence theory with standard gravity and large field fluctuations?
No, with a standard one. You need some non-trivial anisotropic.
Right, which you can get for a scalar field if the field fluctuations are non-linear. So in what sense does this really tell you that it's modified gravity and not quintessence with some field?
You can probably still design it in a quintessence model. I'm not saying it's definitely that it's modified gravity. It's a hint of deviation from lambda CDM and from the vanilla quintessence one. So smooth. You can still conceive. People tend to think that it is more natural to achieve a non-trivial anisotropic stress in a modified theories of gravity more than with the dark fluid. But I'm not saying that's necessarily a modification of gravity. Yeah, it's just for sure a deviation, yeah.
So future data will be able to shrink that deviation?
Yeah, future data we hope will put more stringent constraints. And
how do you measure the deviation? Because it's small. We get systematic errors and so
on. Sorry?
You have systematic errors. So
yeah, you do have. Yeah, yeah. You do have systematic errors. So this, I wouldn't make much out of this because it's mostly just picking up on the tension between weak lensing, very well-known tension between weak lensing and cosmic microwave background data. So I wouldn't conclude much about that. If this tension, if there is really a deviation of mu and gamma from one, we do hope that upcoming surveys such as Euclid, LSST, and WFIRST, things that will combine and achieve high precision measurements of weak lensing, galaxy clustering, doing tomography, will give you the ability. Of course, they have to have a very good control of systematic errors because different type sources of systematic errors can basically mimic these features that we like to interpret as dark energy modified gravity. So there's definitely a lot of work to do in the systematic sector, yeah. This is just to show that what they're picking up is really a model that tends to give slightly lower power on very large scales and a higher CMB lensing. Yes?
So just to comment on this, again, this isn't a criticism of you, but a criticism of Planck. I mean, if they're saying that this, you know, preference for some parameters being non-zero is due to a systematic error, a systematic difference between the data sets, then they just shouldn't have combined those data sets. If you think it's a systematic difference between two data sets, you shouldn't combine. You shouldn't show it's a little bit silly, really, that they show this red to
so
them saying.
Luckily, I'm not in Planck, so I might agree with you. They have a disclaimer at the beginning, right at the beginning of the paper, where they say, we are aware of the dangers of combining data, so we warn you about that, but we have to keep an open mind and look out for it.
Yes.
So I'm not going to make much out of that, tell you that in principle, yeah, data can tell you something about
but
that. But
just to defend Planck team, these are not the same data sets. And Planck is CMB at redshift of 1,000, and I mean BAO they're at redshift.
Yeah.
But if they think they're systematically different, if they think they're systematically
well,
biased,
they think, but they still leave room for model dependence.
That's a theoretical bias. That is, if because we are very conservative, we think okay, if there's a difference, it must be some systematics. But it could be
it's
a near
exactly
theory.
To make sure you don't, you avoid that.
Right, but we know that sometimes it's systematic.
So, it is, okay, so probably that it goes also back to you. They show that indeed if you get CMB lensing, because what I was showing before, it's using Planck without any lensing, CMB lensing information in it. If you put also CMB lensing into the game, the tensions with the lambda CDM with a standard scenario kind of alleviate. So before Switching gears and going to effective field theory of dark energy, let me spend a few more words about this mu and gamma approach. As I was saying, if you want to be completely generic, you can treat this function as generic function of time and scale and try to employ techniques such as principal component analysis, which are very cumbersome. You can try to make some progress from the theoretical point of view, restricting to the quasi-static regime. So it is not that hard to show that for the very broad range of theories, which are theories with one scalar, extrascalar degree of freedom, which obey second-order equations of motion, you generally expect this function of this function mu and gamma to reduce in the quasi-static regime. So when you can neglect time dependencies and focus on special gradients in the equations, they generally reduce to a ratio of even and quadratic polynomials in K. And the just because of the way you have introduced these functions, the denominator of gamma equals the numerator of mu. So basically, if you can safely restrict to the quasi-static regime, which is something that needs to be investigated, you can go from having two generic functions of time and scale to have just only five functions of time. It might not seem like, but it is already a significant reduction in terms of what you need to constrain. And so let me switch gears and go to the effective field theory approach of dark energy and the corresponding implementation in CAM, which is which we dub EFD CAM. So, as I was saying, this approach is still a parametrized approach. It tries to build a model-independent framework to study the dynamics of perturbations and possible deviation from the standard cosmological scenario at the level of linear perturbations. But it tries to be more theoretical, closer to theory, more than phenomenological like the mu and gamma. So it starts from an action. It's built on an action that was proposed a couple of years ago by these people. And the way they build this action basically borrows from techniques that have been used in effective field theory of inflation. So it's trying to working in the Jordan frame, where matter follows the geodesics of the metric, and in working unitary gauge, you can come up with an action, which is an expansion in operators that are the ones of interest if you want to focus on the dynamics of linear perturbations, not necessarily scalar, when the quantities of interest are a metric and the scalar degree of freedom. You can do this expansion. It's an expansion in order of perturbation and also derivatives. And for most of the models of interest and viable models of dark energy, it turns out that this is really all you need, the terms that you need to safely describe in a quite general and model-independent way the dynamics of linear perturbations. In this expansion, your parameters are functions of time. And the first three terms in this action are those that affect the background expansion and the dynamics of perturbations. All these other operators will affect only the dynamics of perturbation. This is an expansion around an FRW background. For us, when we are thinking about tests of gravity on cosmological scales, the way we look at this, it's really just a parametrized action in terms of functions of time. And if we want to use it in order to test in a model-independent way dark energy against cosmological data, then we need to extract predictions for the different spectra and the growth of structure. So it is useful to leave the unitary gauge, and you can do that through the Stuckeberg trick, performing a time diffeomorphism, and going into this action where the extrascalar degree of freedom, the perturbations in the extrascalar degree of freedom are now evident, and they are represented by this pi. So why is this setup interesting? Well, it offers at the same time a model independent and a possibility of approaching your test in a very model independent way, what we call pure EFT approach, that is just forget about details, but just try to learn something from the data about what these functions of time entering the taxon can be. Or you can work in a model-dependent way, specializing to different models of dark energy, and that we refer to as the mapping EFT. That turns out to be a very precise mapping that you can perform for most viable models of dark energy, which have a well-defined Jordan frame and one extrascalar degree of freedom, into this framework. So, for instance, this is a way in which F of R theories could look like in this framework, or minimally coupled quintessence, and you can keep going. Most of the models of interest can be mapped into this language. So you have a sort of unifying language, and if you input that into a software, you have one code for which you can evolve all the models of interest in an exact way, or also being very agnostic and just explore constraints on these functions of time. So, yeah, so as I was saying, either in a model independent or unifying language way. And there are several models of interest that can be fit and map exactly into this framework. So for us, it was really an interesting parameterized approach. And that was kind of going over some of the limitations of previous approaches. And one of the reasons is because it allows an exact mapping of specific models into this language. So we wanted to put it to work by implementing it into CAMB. So basically, you have to work out, of course, the equations for the linear perturbations, which will be, again, a set of Einstein equations that will be very messy, modified ones. The Boltzmann equations, since we are working in the Jordan frame, are the standard ones. And then you can look also at the equation for your pi field. And you have, of course, to choose carefully the right set of equations to evolve in your code. So the idea is now we have something that is very broad, so we can take all the players of interest, matter and metric perturbations, the theory in terms of this generic function of time, and put that into a code that will do all the work for us and eventually output the spectra that we want to compare with data. So this is what we have done, and we have dubbed effective field theory CAMB. This is an example of outputs that you can get, for instance, for F of R theories. And it's the first time, going back to your remark, it's the first time in which F of R theories can be treated exactly, so without any quasi-static approximation, and also on several different backgrounds. So without having, this is one of the improvements with respect to the previous framework that I discussed, the MGCAMB software that needs to be based on lambda CDM backgrounds. In this case, you can go beyond and consider many different backgrounds. And map models exactly. So the good thing of being able to map the model exactly is that you can evolve the full dynamics. You do not have to restrict to any quasi-static approximation or regime. So this is just a snapshot of the structure of the code and all that you can do with it. And it's still a work in progress. It's evolving. We are slowly moving into different directions. So in blue is what is already implemented. In gray is what direction in which we want to do. We want to go, and mostly you can see that, of course, you can use it in the standard GR, so it's like running the usual CAMB, or you can go in what we call pure EFT, so you explore in an agnostic way what happens with your observables, prediction for your observables, making different choices for those functions of time that appear in the action. Or you can specialize to models of dark energy by mapping them exactly into the language. So currently, we have some minimally coupled quintessence or density models and F of R theories built in with many different choices for the background. And we keep going. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done.
Mm-hmm. And when you're implementing these other models, they often have this extra degree of freedom.
One extra, most all these models that I'm implementing have one scalar degree of freedom. For Densky, it's one, it's metric plus one scalar degree of freedom with second order equations of motion.
Some of them have SP2 or other stuff, right?
Some might have. I'm not implementing those. I might implement the coupling limit of models that have different degrees of freedom. So massive gravity, I might implement the decoupling limit of that. So just the regime in which really effectively you care about, one scalar degree of freedom. Yeah. So, and this is to give credits to the younger people involved in it, especially Marco Raveri, who's a PhD student who did a lot of the numerical work along with Bin Hu, and Noemi Frusciante, who did a lot of the theoretical work involved into making this work. So let me spend a few words about some of the virtues of this approach. So I mentioned many times the quasi-static approximation, and that is commonly assumed. It has been commonly assumed so far when studying the dynamics of linear perturbation on sub-horizon scales. What it amounts to typically is indeed restricting to sub-horizon scales, so scales for which k is much, much bigger than ah, the wave number, k. And that, in the standard cosmological scenario, basically automatically implies that you can safely neglect time dependencies of your metric potential with respect to the spatial gradients. That, because that's the typical timescale for the evolution of the potential is of order ah. So it's safe, it works well, it has been tested. We do not really know that much about the how safe quasi-static approximation is in general modifications and non-trivial dark energy models. So it means basically that it is not enough to restrict to sub-horizon scales to be sure that dynamics and time derivatives of your extra scalar degrees of freedom will be negligible. There might be some non-trivial dynamic and there might be some non-trivial sound speed length scale associated with your extra scalar degree of freedom, which might change the range of scales over which the time the quasi-static approximation is good. So one of the good things of our code is that it does not assume that. Of course, not assuming it, it means that it takes more time to run and get out predictions for the observables. So one thing that we can do is use our code in the full version with respect to a quasi-static approximation of it to explore the parameter space for which quasi-static approximation is good or not. Eventually, for those regions in which it is good, the code can switch to a quicker and quasi-static version. So we have started to explore a little bit this and using F of R models, just because those have been widely studied, and there's many papers that have looked at the generalities between massive neutrinos and F of R models. Because at the level of large scale structure, there is indeed a degeneracy, because typically F of R models have this extra scalar degree of freedom, which mediates a fifth force with a characteristic length scale. And what you see at the level of growth of structure is an enhancement of the growth above that below that characteristic length scale. Analogously, in the massive neutrinos, you have a suppression because of free streaming of neutrinos below a characteristic length scale, which is associated to the mass scale of the neutrinos. So you see a sort of degeneracy and washout of the two things. And people have explored combined constraint on massive neutrinos and F of R. But so far, they have done that using quasi-static approximation for F of R. So this is a comparison of what you obtain with data set that use Planck 2013, variant acoustic oscillation and WGLZ, so this is galaxy clustering. Comparing constraints on joint marginalized constraint on the mass of neutrinos and this parameter which labels different F of R models with a lambda CDM expansion history. So this parameter is related to the length scale of your scalar degree of freedom. That's why there is a degeneracy between that and the mass of neutrinos. And comparing what we obtain with our full code, which doesn't assume any quasi-static approximation, and the version of the code that is quasi-static, we do see a difference. And you see that also whether you look at constraints on this parameter B0 with the case of fixed neutrinos mass, or with the varying neutrino mass, the discrepancy between the output of the two codes is more or less significant. So it looks like having massive neutrinos into the game make the quasi-static approximation less good in the case of F of R. It might be that massive neutrinos are probably sourcing some non-trivial dynamics for your extraspiral degree of freedom. This is something we are still investigating, but it's just a hint of, given the accuracy of upcoming surveys, we really want to make sure we model everything properly. And also, it's very important that we have a very accurate code for linear perturbation in order to feed embody simulations with exact and precise initial conditions. The other thing I wanted to comment about in the context of this EFT approach is what we refer to as viability priors. As I mentioned, this approach tends to be closer to theory. You start from a parameterized action, and that turns out to give you a handle on theoretical consistency, on conditions of theoretical consistency of your underlying theory. So even if you work in this sort of agnostic approach in which you do not specialize to a model, but you just explore those functions of time that were entering into the action, you can impose, since you are starting from an action, you can impose some general conditions on those functions in order to make sure that there won't be ghost like degrees of freedom showing up, there won't be gradient instabilities and things like that into your theory. And we impose those conditions right at the beginning of the code. So basically after you perform a choice for either a model or the functional dependence of those functions of time, we run a check that will tell you whether your theory is developing some instabilities or no. And that turns out sometimes to be to place very strong constraints on the parameter space that you can explore. So this is, for instance, an example of what happens if you want to explore F of R theories on a WCDM background. So an equation of state constant, but different from minus one. And B0, again, usual parameter labeling the length scale of your F of R model. So in green, you have all the regions that are excluded by viability conditions. You shouldn't go there. So you see that the parameter space that then you're left to explore and compare with data is significantly reduced. So it's a very good way of being able to take into account conditions of theoretical consistencies, even when you are being model independent. And they can have a big impact. Sometimes they can be stronger than what data can tell you, but especially they can save you time when you have to explore a really wide parameter space. You do not want to waste time into exploring something that corresponds to an unhealthy theory. This is just an example of what Planck, in the recent paper that I mentioned already before, has been able to say about functions in this EFT approach. They have started from a very simple case, which is taking into consideration only the first operator into the taxon. That's, so basically setting to something different than zero, only the conformal coupling function entering in there, omega. And they have explored different time dependencies for this function omega and look at constraints on it. And in particular, you can see here where they have chosen this exponential form and placed constraint on a combination of the value of omega today and beta, and the power beta there. You can see that the contours have a kind of cut, sharp cut up there for higher values of beta. And this comes from the viability conditions that we have imposed. If you wanted to go higher up with values of beta, you would run into a model that has ghost instabilities. So the code prohibits that. So just to say that viability priors can have a strong impact. The way we implement them is through the equation for the pi field. There's a lot of work that we still need to do on that. There's, of course, you are, as a user of the code, you are given the possibility to turn on and off those conditions, because you might agree with me that you don't want Goth to develop, at least on the timescale of interest for the dynamics of the for the evolution of the perturbation that you're looking at, but you might disagree with me, for instance, about having superluminal perturbations or not. So you are given the possibility to turn those conditions on and off, being, of course, warned about the fact that sometimes some of these conditions are not only related to physical stability of your theory, but also mathematical stability. So the code might run into troubles. So let me wrap up. This was a brief tale of our ongoing quest to test gravity on cosmological scales. We have a lot of challenges, but of course we are very excited about the prospect of being able to say something with the high precision data that will be provided to us. I focus mostly on the challenges in the theory sector and the different ways in which we are trying to make progress. Of course, as I mentioned before, there's also the real world out there, and there's systematics, and unfortunately most of the systematics, especially in weak lensing, happens to be degenerate with what we like to think as modifications of gravity or features of dark energy. So there's a lot of work that needs to be done in that sector, in particular in synergy with observers that work with weak lensing and are currently trying to model the systematics effect, in particular the intrinsic alignment, which is a strong source of systematic error there. There's a lot of data, as I was saying, that will be provided to us, and we have understood that the key combination is taking things, data that tell you something about the expansion history, geometric probes, but also combining those with galaxy clustering that brings information coming from spectroscopic redshift and weak lensing. So basically, this gives you a handle on several things, comparing the mapping of matter that you can do through galaxy clustering and that you can do through weak lensing. You can get a handle, for instance, on bias. And also, we have learned that these are probes of non-relativistic dynamics, and these are probes of relativistic dynamics, and they respond to different things in theories of modified gravity and dark energy. So it's a key combination if we want to really explore not only constraints on lambda CDM, but on potential deviations from those. And other things coming up and promising probes are the lensing of the CMB, which has been recently measured to high accuracy from Planck, and of course BMOD's polarization, when we will be we will make some sense of the dust issue. And of course we are looking forward to cross-correlating and combining all these probes. We can learn several things, beat down systematics, learn about bias, but of course we have to be very careful when comparing different probes, and the example of Planck has taught us something about that. And I focus mostly on linear scales. As you can see already at that level, we have several challenges, not only in the theoretical sector, but also in the observational side. There is the whole nonlinear regime that we still need to tackle. There's a lot of work that needs to be done there. And we are currently throwing away a lot of information when doing cosmological tests of gravity, which is all the information that comes from nonlinear scales, simply because we do not know how to model that in a model-independent way. So we need to make progress in that sector, and maybe screening mechanisms will help us doing that. As for this EFT approach, effective field theory approach that I discussed in the last part of the seminar, there's several things that we need to do and we're currently working on, ranging from more theoretical to more observational aspects. On the theoretical side, we want to optimize this framework. So whatever theoretical input can be put into that, it is really welcome and much needed. This is just, again, showing effects of viability prior. So all the black regions are those that are viable according to conditions of theoretical consistency. And as you can see, depending on models and parameters that you explore, the cut can be significant. Of course, we need to make sure we are implementing the right conditions and maybe we can implement further ones. So there's a lot of investigation that needs to be done there. Further investigation of the quasi-static approximation, that is crucial in order to have an accurate setup for to provide observers in order to compare and conclude something about their data. There's, as I was saying, the modeling of weak lengths in systematics, which a big chunk of the weak lengths in systematics is model dependent. So it depends on the underlying theory of gravity that you are assuming. So there's a strong degeneracy with what we are trying to do. And of course, you can repeat the exercise of the principal component analysis that we have done for mu and gamma for this CFT function. So in order to gain an idea of how many degrees of freedom of this function entering the action you can really constrain, at what redshifts, which survey will be best at constraining this function, which combinations of surveys, and so on. And of course, there's a software behind all this. There is this, the implementation of this EFT approach into CAMB that requires a lot of numerical work. And if you want it to be fast, accurate, flexible, and so on, you really need to use ad hoc algorithms, be basically high-performance computing technique. And we have made this code publicly available, so people can download it. That's how Planck got it and used it. That means also a lot of work in order to keep a user-friendly code and also collaborate with a large collaboration such as Planck in order to make sure they make the best use of this code. So this is just some of the upcoming things that we need to do in this EFT approach, and I will leave you here with a dream of cosmological test of gravity.
You describe it. What is the difference
between layer fields down here and UV differentiation? Well, it's the main difference, for instance, is that now we have matter perturbation in the matter fields, which are important at that play. So, for instance, you have the conformal coupling function omega, which cannot be really scale away, and it's very similar. I'm not sure there are big differences. Yeah.
I want to get back to my original comment. The simplest explanation for dark energy is that lambda is a constant.
Yeah.
Now, 2015 Planck data, the fit to the acoustical power spectrum is 1%. Omega lambda is an order 4 or 5 figures. So what constraint does that produce on FOVR?
Well, on FOVR, I can show you what constraints it puts.
Just this particular set of data.
This is the constraints on FOVR, for instance, and this is the here is the part. So these are FOVR models which mimic a lambda CDM background, but have a length scale associated with the scalar degree of freedom. So going to zero for B0, zero would be lambda CDM exactly, no extra scalar degree of freedom. So, I mean, there are constraints, but they are not that strong. The Planck data, I mean, it is, lambda CDM is a very good fit, but there's room for deviations. In the CMB lensing, there's a slight discrepancy between the best fit and really the data points. You have also the low multiples discrepancies, so that there's still space.
But what Jesus omega lambda has to be known to 4 or 5 figures?
Well, omega lambda, I might not really modify that, right? I mean, I can have models which at the background really give you something that is really similar and very close to a constant equation of state, and an omega lambda of 70% or whatever it is, 68%. But still at the level of perturbations, I can have a non-trivial dynamics. Then FOVR in itself, maybe it's not the most interesting and well-justified model, but there's still room.
this last slide where you were showing the theoretical stability constraints, mm-hmm. there was this term that had a single time derivative on pi.
Oh,
we're
sorry.
It's here,
yeah.
Before your
conclusion. Looked like a
drag term. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so where can a term like that come from?
Sorry, which term?
The term is second one that has a P times pi dot.
Here?
The second P times pi
dot. Oh, okay. What do you mean where it comes from?
Where does it come from? Because I would think in the Lagrangian, if I had such a term like that, I could always just integrate by parts.
No, I don't think. I'm not sure what that is in terms of the function entering the Lagrangian, but I'm sure you cannot integrate anything out of here. I'm not sure if that's it's related to heavy matter fields at play.
Isn't that just a Hubble graph? You can have a Hubble graph like that. But if I think
of it as coming from varying some quadratic term in the Lagrangian, I can always integrate by parts to eliminate terms like
I'm not sure. Yeah,
functions of time that appear in front, then they then would give generic something like that. If you don't have, if you have a static Lagrangian, that's true, but if you have a function of time that appears.
Yeah, I'm not sure to which, I don't remember to which combination of these functions, but I'm
but
sure
it
can
not,
be really.
B is not an independent function, B must be.
Well, it's, all those coefficients, sorry, maybe it wasn't clear because I called them A, B, C, D, all those coefficients will be just combination of these functions entering this action.
So they're not independent.
Yeah, no. Yeah, sorry. Yeah.
So you showed a picture of you and your, I guess your son, and then some other people, I didn't say who they were.
Daughter, actually.
Oh, yeah, daughter, sorry.
Everybody makes mistakes.
Made a mistake. Okay, sorry. Made a mistake.
It's okay.
So, but who are the other people?
So this is, she's Noemi Frusciante. She was actually Thomas's PhD student in CISA, and she did part of her PhD also with me. And she's now a postdoc at IFF in Paris. Marco Raveri is currently undertaking his PhD with me. He's at CISA, because that's where I was 2 years ago before moving to Leiden. So he's now spending half time in CISA, half time in Leiden. And this is Bing, who is a postdoc in Leiden. Yeah. So these two guys are the ones that work really, really, really hard from the numerical point of view and made this possible. Marco is undertaking a master, besides PhD in physics, he's undertaking a master in high-performance computing. So that made a huge difference in what we were able to do. Yeah.
Okay, the same goes under again.